I'm Hillary.
And I'm Sandra. Coming up on the podcast, we're going to talk to the author of The Vagina Bible. She's everywhere right now. Her name is Dr. Jen Gunter. And yeah, we're going to talk about vaginas for the entire episode.
Do you want to say it one more time, Sandra?
No.
Vagina.
Vagina.
No, vagina.
Vagina.
We're going to break down all the myths. Jen's going to tell it like it is. You're going to want to hear.
The Quick and the Dirty Podcast with Hillary Welch and Sandra Plagakis.
Now that we're talking about vaginas, can we talk about mine?
Well, not vagina. Okay.
It's close to it, though.
Okay, what is going on?
Okay, I have a UTI. I want everybody to know.
Why? Why would you want to share that?
What's hilarious is that first of all, I just want you to know I haven't had a UTI in 25 years. And I got one and I mentioned it to people I work with and they're all looking at me like I'm a hoe.
Well, you are, but what do you mean? It's not hoe related?
No, it's not hoe related at all. I got the no dick UTI. I don't even know how one gets, I'm like, what did I sit on something? Like literally, like talk about misinformed, but I'm like, how do you get a UTI if, you know, you haven't been pounded mercilessly?
Did you wipe the wrong way?
No, like, I think
that's
good.
Where it's from.
I know. I've been doing it for 40 something years. I know how to do it. Why now would I have a UTI? You know what I mean? I would have had them way sooner.
You know what? I didn't learn until I was in my like late 20s that you have to pee after sex so you don't get one.
I do anyway, because I just want to get the hell out of there.
I've got to go pee. And then you leave.
You just go. And then you just like put your hair together again. You know, you make sure you don't look like, you know, death or whatever it is. You just want it. You want your sexy afterglow. But 25 years ago, Hillary, I got my first UTI, one of two. And I remember it was the worst thing in the world.
What happened?
I got pounded mercilessly.
By whom?
By my now husband.
Oh, well, that's less sexy.
It wasn't just some rando I met in a bar.
I know. I wanted the hot story. I was like, where are we going with this?
Who did me seven times in a night. No, it wasn't that. Not at all. It was Tim. And it was like the first... like time we had sex, once we started doing it, mm-hmm. we didn't come up for air for weeks. And then eventually, times have changed, by the way, but oh, have they ever. And, but I remember I went to squat, and that I will never forget the pain. And it went on for about a day before I ended up going to a doctor and getting, you know, antibiotics. But that is something, isn't it?
Well, there's something about getting a UTI because it can be sexually transmitted, but more often than not, it's just bacteria that went the wrong way in your urethra,
not
right?
Sexy.
But it's so funny when something like that happens. You immediately look at your partner like, "What did you do to me?" Because you don't know exactly that it's a UTI. You're like, "Did you have something? Did you give me something?"
I have the clap. Great. Super duper. I have gonorrhea or the clap.
Like the mind just goes and it's something super minor. But as soon as something itches or feels weird or is different, you freak out.
That's fun. Is that your initial thought?
Oh, always. It's like, I'm dying.
No, but do you immediately want to...
All of my bad behavior from my youth has finally caught up with me.
It was prolonged, the clap, but I got it anyway. I knew I was going to get it eventually. Listen, I've always said I've won the lottery. I'm a Montreal girl who's never had an STD. I'm a unicorn. Right here, right now. But I never thought of blaming my significant other because who's having sex in my house? I don't think either one of us is right now. And if I think I would be more proud of him that he could get somebody to bang him, you know, with his sexy minivan that he drives, like, you know. It's not really a chick mobile, is what I'm saying. I would be more apt to give him a high five if he passed along the gonorrhea to me than I would be upset. I'd be like, good for you. Good for you. Well done.
Are you on antibiotics?
Yeah. And it doesn't hurt as much to pee, but I do still pee 74 times a day.
But that's nothing new.
That's nothing new. And even the doctor was like, do you pee a lot? I'm like, four times an hour, like clockwork. Nothing's really changing.
All right. This started down a terrible, terrible path, but it's going to continue to goodness, I think.
I think
we're going to turn this around.
I think we're going to become a lot more educational and a lot more positive, and I love the conversation we're about to have.
And we'll talk a lot less shit, let's be honest.
Let's try to act professional, okay? You and me, okay?
Wish us luck.
We are so excited about today's guest, partly because we're hoping to say the word vagina a lot over the next hour. And the other reason is because she is straight up awesome. She is an OBGYN. She is a health columnist, the host of Gensplaining, and she also happens to be the author of The Vagina Bible. Please welcome to the Quick and the Dirty podcast, Dr. Jen Gunter. Hey!
Hey, thank you for having me.
Oh my gosh, we are so excited to talk to you because clearly if you have to write a book called The Vagina Bible, we have a lot of learning to do.
Yes, no kidding.
Well, you know, a lot of information to have, a lot of information that hasn't been out there. And I think people have had a hard time saying the word vagina and vulva in public, and that makes it hard for people to get information.
What, but why is it hard to get information? I mean, it's 2019.
Yeah, I know, right?
Like, that freaks me out.
Yeah, it does. But it's, you know, I think it's like a constellation of multiple factors. So, first of all, there's this whole concept of shame. You know, people can't talk about their vaginas and vulvas the way they can talk about their elbows or their low back pain, right? So, if you can't talk about something, the implication is it's shameful. And if it's shameful, you're going to end up going to clandestine places for information, not to medical professionals.
Right, because we've all looked at the internet and thought we were dying.
Right, exactly. But then medicine hasn't done a good job of explaining a lot of these things to women and taking concerns seriously and brushing women off when they have symptoms. And so there's that. And then you have just folklore and dogma that's been around since the beginning of time. And, you know, it's so hard to undo myths and mythology. And I had this day in the office where I had seen about five women who had all had misconceptions about their bodies, had done things that medically, you know, they probably shouldn't have because of that. And they'd taken advice from, you know, boyfriends or mothers or sisters or doctors or the internet. And when I corrected them, each one of them said, how did I not know that? And so I think this misinformation can come from so many places. I mean, many stores still sell douches. They have warning labels that say that they are harmful to you, like cigarettes are, and yet people still buy them. So if you have these whole, you see this advertising everywhere you go that your vagina is dirty, because that's sort of the core tenet of the patriarchy, that there's something wrong with women's bodies. If you see that advertising everywhere, of course, it would be natural to think that that might stick for some people.
It's funny, as a child of the 80s, like we were obsessed with douche back then because we didn't know any better. So, you know, every girl I knew was douching, and we're talking about teenage girls. You want to talk about ridiculous? That was ridiculous. But I have never been told different over time. You know, like you're telling me different now that douching is ridiculous, but nowhere along the way has there been some sort of a article or, you know, something that has told me not to douche.
You know, I think they do appear in some places, but it's usually like a throwaway line. Right?
Right.
So it's not like in the States, they have warning labels just like cigarettes. They do.
Wow.
And so, you know, and then people say, well, why do they sell them if they're so bad? And I'm like, well, they sell cigarettes, don't they? I mean,
yeah.
You know, capitalism, right? That's why. And there's a lot of money to be made in making women feel shamed about their body parts.
So where do you think that whole vibe of shame and dirtiness originated from for the female body?
Oh, I think it's from the beginning of time. I mean, if you go historically and go back centuries and centuries and centuries, I mean, many religions, many cultures have excluded women during menstruation with this belief that that makes them dirty or toxic, which is actually not only medically stupid, but you can use common sense to break that down. If menstrual blood is dirty and toxic, how does an embryo implant in it? Because that's what an embryo grows in, menstrual blood. I mean, you don't get your period, you get pregnant, that, you know, so it's just been used, you know, since the beginning of time to say that women are unclean, women are dirty. And, you know, you still hear it today. I mean, you hear, you know, people are, that's why we have this whole now, instead of sort of douching was sort of like the 70s, 80s. And what we have now is this industry in intimate wipes, right? That women need to wipe their vulvas, wipe their rectums, and all these baby wipes are sold to women. Nobody sells baby wipes to men, but they have rectums. Why does no one care about the rectums of men? Why are they not dirty?
Because of the patriarchy. I think that's easily explained.
Like, women apparently need to prep themselves for men. And I'm like, no, wait a minute. This is my tagline. Please wash them and bring them to my tent. You know?
Sandra, growing up, when you were a young girl, did you have to hide the fact that you had your period from your dad? Like, you would live in a traditional Greek household, three women, one dude. Yeah. How did that all roll out?
No, it wasn't that bad. It really wasn't that bad. It wasn't ever anything that we spoke about publicly with my father. But no, I don't particularly remember feeling shame about it with my father. But there was, you know, that aspect of him. I didn't want him to view me as a woman.
Right.
Because nobody wants that when they're 12. There was more shame about it at school with the boys.
Right.
Who are always like brutal.
The reason I asked is I can remember from the time I got my period, I had to take my own garbage out in my bedroom because it was like not to be spoken about.
What?
Yeah.
Like your mother told you not to tell your dad or you decided that?
So I don't know, like, is that a pretty normal thing in households? Maybe my household's like pretty weird.
You know, it's funny that, well, I guess it gets back to the whole central tenet of women being toxic on their periods, right? Like, it's everything that you said is, you know, I've had that same experience of being in school and, you know, leaking on your clothes, that's like, you're so embarrassed about that. But if you got a nosebleed, you wouldn't be embarrassed, right?
Absolutely not.
You know,
right.
If you got a nosebleed, your teacher would jump up and say, oh my gosh, or the person sitting next to you would be like, here's a Kleenex, right? But if you leak blood, it's like, oh, taboo, even though it's just blood. It's the same thing. Why is one shameful and one isn't? And, you know, middle school is brutal, right, to begin with.
Oh my gosh.
You know, and so anything that makes you visibly different for that second is that thing that gets weaponized against you. And that's how kids get bullied for all different kinds of reasons. And, you know, this idea that, you know, that young girls who are in a very formative time, right? Like, we know that young girls are very vulnerable to body image disorders sort of in those middle school years and maybe even a little bit younger. I mean, if you say to a young girl that she's overweight or you tell her she's fat, you can give her an eating disorder. Like with one sentence, you can basically cast a curse of a body image disorder. So you have this sort of time that women are uniquely vulnerable to body image, you know, disorders or issues. And then you have this time of unique bullying. And then you have this sort of cultural shame. And so I think it's sort of a perfect firestorm to set many women up for this lifelong, you know, sort of hiding the tampons on the way to the bathroom. And, I think I just carry it out there. Who cares? You know?
Who cares? You know, just hearing you say that, Jen, takes me back to grade 5 when this girl in my class named Sonia was the first to get her period. And the teacher treated it like the biggest thing in the world, that it became like everyone was whispering, Sonia got her period. Sonia got her period. And the teacher like panicked. She went to like a cupboard and brought a box of, I guess they had tampons at the school.
Oh.
And march them into the bathroom, you know, where poor shamed Sonia was waiting,
right,
who was bleeding all over herself. It was, as a woman, I was so mortified for her that day. Just mortified.
Think about if you were a kid who had a stomach ache and they were out of toilet paper in the bathroom. No one would make a big deal. They'd just be like, oh, here's a roll of toilet paper. Right?
Right. And here I am 35 years later telling you, more than 35 years later, telling you the story of Sonia being shamed in the bathroom. It was unforgettable.
Right.
It was so bad.
You know, and think about, you know, that happens in classrooms everywhere around the world all the time still today. And it's just ridiculous. It's absolutely ridiculous that, you know, ooh, Sonia got her period. So then, okay, so what's the implication of that? Do you worry like Sonia's going to start going out having sex now? Like this is like the second women start bleeding, they're like, okay, let's go have, like, having your period doesn't make you a woman, right? It just means that you're now in you know, a different stage of puberty. So we've attached all these sort of things to it that are just, it's just a phase of life. Like I tell people, you know, getting your period is in a way not much different than getting acne when you go through puberty, right? Like it's just a stage. And
right. It's basically a pain in the ass, just like acne.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it is a nuisance. It does. And, you know, for us where, you know, we may have access to products, it's a nuisance. But I mean, there's women, I mean, period poverty is a real issue. There are women who, and girls who can't get the products they need. They don't leave the house. They end up getting skin conditions or irritation because they're reusing rags that aren't cleaned. They miss school, so they don't graduate. I mean, this happens in many countries. So, you know, there are some significant sort of economic, you know, downstream issues. And then there's countries where, you know, girls and women literally have to go to menstrual huts. They're not allowed to walk into the kitchen when they're on their period. I mean, what message does that send? That's horrible.
God, that is unbelievable.
You know?
I want to ask you about, like Hillary alluded to, shame and vagina shame, but beyond the period thing and the boys teasing us, I have never like loved my vagina either. You know what I mean? And I still, part of it is that I just don't have a great relationship with it and that I don't understand. And I have never understood how it works, to be perfectly honest with you. Does that make sense?
Well, I mean, it yes and no. I mean, I think that...
Well, no, I'm saying something. I mean, that sounds dumb saying. I know how it works. I get how it works. But I don't... Like, I've never really taken the time to have this relationship with my vagina.
Well, but I think that...
And I know Hillary's laughing because she knows it's true.
But okay,
I don't talk about my vagina. It's there. I deal with it. I move on.
Do you have a relationship with your knee?
Not really.
Like, so I don't think that, like being sort of this idea of like sort of being in tune with your body parts is very much this sort of, I think, like a trend. And, you know, as a doctor, I think it's great to know how have as much knowledge about every body part as possible, right? That way, then when you have a problem, you can use the right language to get medical care. You know, knowing about your knee wouldn't just help you. So we'll use something that's totally like non-sexual as a comparison. So knowing about your knee would be interesting in case you have knee pain or you twist your knee, so you can go to the doctor and you can say, well, I need this test or I don't, or what's going on. Knowing about your knee would be helpful if you want to become a runner, so then you know how to look after it in more extreme circumstances. So, you know, if you think about that for your vagina, you know, it would be good to have that same working knowledge, like, you know, what happens each month, what might be the impact of birth control, what might be the impact of sex, what might be the impact of STDs, you know, what's kind of the general maintenance that I should think about. And then, you know, what do I need to know about having sex? Are there things that I should be doing, I could be doing? And so, you know, I tend to think about it, I wouldn't say in a clinical way, but just in kind of like a basic knowledge way. You know, but everybody's different. I mean, some people are like, they really like to, you know, I would say, you know, worship their body parts and talk about things. And that's great. I mean, it's your jam. That's fine. You know, I mean, I think whatever works for you is what works. As long as you're not having a medical problem, and as long as you're having the sex that you want to have, that's great.
Oh, no, I'm definitely not.
Do you think
that's another issue.
Do you think that whole worshiping thing comes from that need to get over our own shame? Like, it's kind of, it's to sort of counteract that. Like, if I feel shame, then I'm going to pretend that I love it, and then maybe I can find myself somewhere in the middle.
I don't know. I think it's an odd mix of weird things because I hear the language in some of that, and sometimes I hear some of the words of the patriarchy, like, oh, it's like wholesome and natural and pure and, you know, my goddess. And those are words that don't sound, on the surface, they sound empowering, but to me, they have a darker undercurrent. Like that's what the patriarchy wants, you know,
right.
The patriarchy wants to put your vagina on a pedestal. The patriarchy wants to do that because then you're going to keep it pure from it. So to me, that has, and I obviously view things through a different lens, but that just does have some overtones, has a lot of overlap with the wellness industry, which is very predatory, and does use some of the same language of the patriarchy. So, you know, this whole, So to me, it has that connotation. But if it doesn't to someone else, that's great. I mean, it's your body and you get to treat it how you want. And if that's what makes you feel good about it, great. Okay.
Why do you think that they're able to take something like a vagina that, you know, you make the comparison of a knee and a vagina. They're not commercializing our knees. How come they're able to commercialize our vaginas?
Well, I mean, they are to some extent. I mean, people are telling you to buy all these powdered collagens to help your knee pain and all this. So there's a lot of that. But there's the added shame about the vagina that you can't talk about it. So if you can't talk about it, your doctor dismisses you, then you end up in these other places. So it's easier to weaponize something that has shame attached to it. That's why I think just, you know, the act, you know, it's the basic act of revolution just to talk about your body parts.
It's funny how we talk about female empowerment and what you just talked about, how we've managed to find shame in our vaginas. Are we going in the right direction? Because almost every woman I know, myself included, is totally obsessed with their grooming habits of their vagina and presenting it to be this pretty little flower.
Yeah, again, pretty little flower, because that's what the patriarchy wants. The patriarchy doesn't want strong
women. That's,
you know?
Right.
So, you know, again, and you know, personally, I dislike euphemisms for the vagina. I mean, you know, if a guy wants to call your vagina your flower, I mean, that's infantilizing it to me.
Right.
Again, if that's what works in your relationship and there's no other aspects of sort of infantilizing you and that's your guy's specific kink, okay, sure. So I think you're going to have to separate out, is that your little kink versus is that an infantilizing way
right.
to talk about your grown-up woman parts, right?
I was like, I'm going to call mine Steve. How does that work for you?
So, you know, so I think that you just, and the whole grooming thing is, why is nobody obsessed about male grooming, right?
Well, there is a little bit of that, but not to the same degree as females,
not
for
to
sure.
Not the same degree at all.
Right. I don't know too many guys who go out and get their penises waxed.
Well, all you have to do,
or penises lasered.
But all you have to do is take the cover of any women's magazine, and I would say every second month there's something about pubic hair. That's not the same in men's magazines at all. Right?
Right.
And pubic hair serves the same function for both of us. In fact, it's more important probably for women because, you know, the vulvar skin has a higher moisture content and pubic hair traps the moisture. It provides a mechanical barrier. It traps dirt and debris. And it probably has a role in sexual function because, you know, when each pubic hair is attached to a nerve ending, that's why it hurts when you get it ripped out. And so tugging on it stimulates nerves and that's part of your sexual response cycle. So, you know, I mean, it's to each their own. I mean, if you get your tongue pierced, there's health consequences, and some people choose to do it and other people don't. And that's my whole shtick, I would say, or not shtick, but my belief is informed consent. You know, if you just think, well, I mean, I see young women in the office who think having pubic hair is abnormal. Like, they think that's, like, that means, like, that it's gross, it's wrong to have pubic hair. And I'm like, no, that's actually the default is pubic hair. If you choose to remove it, you're a grown up, you get to do whatever you want with your body, but this is what pubic hair does. These are the potential consequences. And then you make that decision. I mean, that is informed consent.
Isn't it more concerning that there are men out there who think that pubic hair is abnormal?
Well, it is, you know, so I think that's personally a form of emotional abuse when heterosexual men tell their partners how their vulvas and vaginas should look and how they could make it look prettier. Because nobody should be telling you, first of all, anything about your body that could be better. And that would be the only thing I wish I had known when I was 15 and started dating was the first time some guy tells you how you could be better, you should dump him. Because,
boy, if we could all have a conversation with our 15-year-old selves, right?
I mean, that should be it. If they either like you or they don't. And if they don't like what you have, then you don't change yourself for them. You say, okay, well, goodbye. You know, but that's so many women, you know, sort of almost like backlead. They keep changing themselves to sort of, you know, suit this man. And this just is a very common weight in heterosexual relationships. And I think the other problem that comes from that, because we don't talk about sex, and we don't talk about what good sex is, when you start being sexually active, whether you're 15 or 18 or 20 or 25 or whatever age it is, most heterosexual women learn the mechanics of sex from the least informed person, a heterosexual man.
Amen.
That's right. Wow, you know what? You didn't. Wow, hold on. I need a minute with
That's just going to take a second.
That explains a lot.
It really does.
Yeah.
I got to ask, your book has been out for a while now. Who's buying your book? Men or women?
Well, mostly women. But you know, a lot of, you know, there, you know, I know I'm always like dunking on like the patriarchy, and when I'm doing that, I'm not dunking on the allies. There are wonderful men, and there are wonderful allies. And you know what? They're hurt by the patriarchy too. The patriarchy is sort of toxic masculinity that is, you know, imbued in our society, and that hurts. You know, that hurts everybody except, you know, a small percentage who tend to hold the power. So, so a lot of men buying it for their partners. It's awesome when I'm at book signings. I was at the Ottawa Writers Festival the other day, and, you know, this woman, probably like in her 70s, late 70s, was there with a book, and you know, she, and I love when the old ladies come up to you. I should be careful saying old ladies because it's all perspective. I'm going to be there pretty soon. she put her book out, and I'm like, well, how, you know, I said, thank you so much for coming, and you know, what would you like me to write in it? And she kind of looked at me with this, you know, kind of like, not stern face, but you know, like respectable older woman face. And I said, would you like me to write fuck the patriarchy? And she went, and her whole face just lit up, and she said, yes, yes, I would.
I love her. I'm like in love with this woman. I've never met her. Oh, that's so cute.
But that happens every book signing. I'll have this older woman there who's generally by herself. And she's, you know, just sweet, just, you know, like you would sit beside her on the bus and go, oh, hi, how are you? And, you know, they come up to have the book signed, and I always ask them, you know, would you like me to write fuck the patriarchy? And they just, their face just lights up.
Ah, oh, that's so amazing. Jen, I think it's so interesting that you're calling the book The Vagina Bible, because when I think about what I learned about my body, most of it didn't come from a medical source. It didn't come from a book. It came from my mother and what she learned from her mother. And it was sort of like myths passed down through time. What do you think is the most inaccurate or even dangerous thing that we've learned from our mothers through time, like a common misconception?
Well, I mean, it probably depends on your mother, but, you know, mine said tampons are evil and dangerous and will kill you, so that's a myth. mine said that,
oh boy,
mine said that sex was bad and evil and will kill you.
That's not what mine said.
You know, I think that probably the biggest problem is just the inability to talk about it accurately. You know, there's some girls who came from very open households and everybody talk about everything. But, you know, I think that it's easy to sort of judge our mothers, and, you know, probably easier for me to judge mine than anyone else. But I think that you also have to look at the context in which they were raised, right?
Oh, yeah. I just mean that was like the tradition was you learn about your body from your mother, who learned about it from their mother. And I kind of feel like it's like the telephone game where by the end, it's like, that's not where we started.
But you have to remember, too, everybody starting with information about the vagina and vulva was inaccurate. Because we didn't have science back then. We didn't, you know, thousands of years ago when people were trying to educate their daughters about menstruation, they didn't know what it was. They didn't know how it came. They knew nothing about it. So, you know, so I think that, you know, and, you know, when did women, you know, get the right to go to school? When were women starting to graduate from college? I mean, in the history of humanity, you know, that's relatively recent, right? I mean, women were property. So mothers were terrified their daughters wouldn't be marriage prospects. So that has influenced probably up until maybe the last 10 or 15 years what young girls have been taught. It's still probably there. I mean, if it's been since the beginning of time, how do you erase that in just a generation? You can't. I mean, you know, women were afraid. Like, my mother had to get married. Like, women didn't have jobs. Right? Like you maybe had a job, you had a job until you got married, and then you stopped working. If you kept working as a woman, it was because you were a spinster. I mean,
you know, it's funny that we're having this conversation about the patriarchy and we're talking about our mothers, and I was not even aware that I was so indoctrinated by the patriarchy until very late in life. Like, I'm in my 40s now, and it was my 40s that I became woke, as they say. I never thought about it. It was just my life. And it's embarrassing to even say that, but true. But looking back, growing up, Jen, we didn't talk about sex in my house, and there was an understanding that my job was to get an education, marry a nice boy, and that was going to be the way it goes, because I grew up in a traditional European household. And it's amazing how many young women, and specifically those of with European parents, I can't speak to Canadian parents, but had that same experience that we knew, like we were, I got a book about sex when I was 14. That was it. And I asked my mom some questions that got answered, but we didn't sit around, you know, mulling it over. and that was it. I was to get married young to a nice boy. That was the expectation.
Yeah. I mean, in my household, that wasn't my household was men were horrible and evil and you need to have a job so you never have to depend on a man.
Well, my mother tried to instill that in me as well. And it worked out pretty well for me in the end, and that's because I moved out when I was 22. Had I stayed, I don't know how it would have ended.
Yeah.
But it's just one of those things. I was the black sheep because I didn't stay. I left before I got married. the humanity.
Right. I know. So just think about it. Just like it's just even just so in our recent history, if you think about, you know, humanity and how long we've been here, like it's only been in the last, 10, 15 years that we've been saying to women, you can do what you want. Like, you know, your worth isn't dependent on getting married. And, you know, not everybody wants to partner with men. Like, let's have those conversations too. Because, you know, it's really interesting. You know, I see all these women who have body image issues about their vulvas and vaginas because of things men have told them. I don't ever see women who partner with women who have those issues. Right? And, you know, you think about why are, you know, that women who are partnering with women have more orgasms in their sexual relationship than women who partner with men. I mean, because they're partnering with someone who knows the parts. They know what they're doing. It makes a big difference. So I just think it's...
Right. And they respect the part,
you know,
too.
So I think it's super important to sort of, you know, this whole traditional idea about, you know, traditional marriage, quote, whatever that means, or what it's meant historically, has certainly not been beneficial to women. And it's forced women to, you know, I mean, imagine you get that message and you're a young gay girl, and, you know, the only message you get from your mother is you need to go marry a boy. Like, how does that help you be open about your body or learn things? I mean, you know, you're sort of getting such bad messages from the beginning. So I think it's just, that's why I think just facts and education are the way to go and just present it well. So here's information and you just make those choices that work for you.
Do you think that the sort of commercial and capitalist environment is now, because we're talking about our vaginas and our bodies, more finding a new way to make money from us?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's... The more you can talk about vaginas, the more people are going to find a way to sell you products for it, you know. And it's, the products are so scammy, it's ridiculous. And they all play on this fear of lack of information. I mean, the one great thing that's, I mean, you know, if people read my book, then they'll realize they don't need any of those products. And I actually heard a really great story from, because my book is in Shoppers Drug Mart, and this man showed up, and he was talking to a male pharmacist, and he said he needed a product for his wife to balance her pH. You know, ooh. And the male pharmacist looked at him and said, "You don't need that. What you need is this book."
Oh, wow.
Oh, wow. That's
Can I get
incredible.
A prescription, Dr. Jen?
Yeah. I mean, seriously. Like, and he said, "We don't sell those products here. They're harmful. You need to read this book so that you can understand, you know, if there's a medical problem or if there isn't."
What do you think is the biggest scam product being sold and popular right now?
Oh, right now, I would say all the CBD products and the cannabis products for the vagina.
Damn it. Are you talking about the lube?
All of it.
Why?
Okay. So let me rephrase it to you. What if the pharmaceutical industry came out with products with cannabis for the vagina and a lube, and they had it all approved without any studies and made all these claims? Would you say, "Hey, man, the pharmaceutical industry is trying to put one over on me," wouldn't you?
Right.
Well, that's exactly what's happening with Big Wellness. These products are completely unstudied. We know that actually women who use cannabis are more likely to be colonized with yeast. The very little we know about cannabis and sexual function is when women are sexually stimulated, their natural levels of endocannabinoids actually go down. They don't go up. So, you know, people who report that they have better sexual experiences while they're using cannabis, it could just be because they think they are, or maybe because they have less anxiety, not because they're actually getting a pharmaceutical benefit from cannabis. The lubes are completely unstudied in the vagina. We don't know how they could damage the vaginal ecosystem. This idea that cannabis has a net positive effect on every cell in the body is absolutely ridiculous, because no compound can do that. And what's the effect of chronically stimulating those endocannabinoid receptors? We don't even know if there's endocannabinoid receptors in the vagina. So the bulk of the information that we know about cannabis is it increases your colonization of yeast. It decreases sugar storage in your vaginal cells, which is important for keeping your healthy bacteria. And natural levels of endocannabinoids go down when you're sexually stimulated. So use it at your own risk.
What if you are a woman of a certain age and you need a little helper? What do you do?
If you want lube, then you go to the drugstore and get some silicone-based lube. That's the best for people who are postmenopausal, but some people like water-based lubes. I personally can't stand the feel of them. But yeah, just get a good silicone-based lube.
Good, because I just want to feel again.
Yeah, and you know, vaginal estrogen will make a huge difference for women who are getting close to perimenopause or menopause. That will make a huge difference as well. That will make your cells pretty much like they were when you were 30.
Oh my God!
Make an appointment, Sandra. Stat.
I wrote it down. I circled it, and I put a star next to it. Vaginal estrogen. Yeah. I'm in.
So there are a lot of good things to do. So it just depends on what the actual problem is, right? You know, and for low libido, one of the best treatments is medical mindfulness, meaning erotica. So thinking about, imagining fantasies, thinking about sexual scenarios. I mean, that's what I do all the time. That's why I'm always thinking about, sex with my person, because I'm always thinking about sex with my person. You know, and once you start thinking about it, you're like, ooh, yeah, that'd be great. I imagine all kinds of scenarios and things, and that's what gets your libido up. There's a wonderful book by Dr. Lori Brado, who is a Canadian sex researcher. She's a PhD sex researcher from the University of British Columbia, and it's called Better Sex Through Mindfulness.
Who knew? It seems like the obvious
right.
answer. Erotica. Obviously. Can I ask you something about vaginal steaming? Because we were talking about the biggest myths out there. I read a story the other day on my radio show about vaginal steaming, and I thought, the hell is that? Right. Is it as dumb as I think it is?
It's a total scam. It's an absolute, absolute scam. I mean, first of all, if you're squatting over a pot of steaming herbs, which are actually mostly allergens, the steam's not going to get in your vagina. But if it did, that would be bad, because your vagina is a low oxygen environment. So it does not want to have, doesn't want to have oxygen in it. And the thing that people forget is vaginal steaming exists because historically, people thought the uterus was full of toxins, and it was to clean the uterus. So any wellness person who is promoting vaginal steaming is literally promoting the patriarchy.
Thanks,
literally.
Gwyneth Paltrow.
Yeah.
Screw you.
They've just wrapped it up with a pink bow and tried to call it feminism, but it's the exact opposite.
So we're just doing the same thing over and over and over again in terms of supporting the patriarchy. We're just finding new and interesting ways to do it, i.e. vaginal steaming, cannabis lube.
Yeah, well, anything that's untested. You ask yourself, what are the ethics of promoting untested products?
Interesting.
That's what people are doing. It's capitalism. It's not wellness. It's capitalism. So it kills me how all these cannabis products get a total pass. You have no idea if it's safe or not. People thought tobacco was super safe for years. And I mean, I'm not saying that recreational cannabis is harmful in the way that, whatever recreational cocaine is. That's not what I'm saying. But when you're using it every day for your health, we don't know what the long-term impacts are on different body parts, because applying it to your vagina or applying it somewhere, we don't know what we don't know. For example, we know that certain lubes that have what are called high osmolality, which means a low water content, are extremely damaging to the lining of the vagina. I don't know what the osmolality of any cannabis lubes are. They don't write that down.
Interesting stuff.
Wow.
So, you know, so there's all these ways that, you know, people, you know, or, you know, CBD bath soaks. Well, we don't know what the impact is of having, you know, CBD all over your skin and what we don't know. We don't know. Maybe it's good. Maybe it's not. People thought the sun was great until they realized that, you know, being in the sun caused cancer. I mean, we, you know, when things are unstudied, we don't know what we don't know. And I always say that, you know, health trends cannot be healthy because it takes years and years and years to get data to study to know the impact of things. So I would say that what's your bother factor that you want to treat and be very careful about, you know, how do you know this product is going to treat that problem? Where are there studies? And when it's wellness, there's no studies because you know what? If there's studies and things work, it becomes medicine.
True enough.
And we find out too little too late, what the truth is, like you say, years later about sun damage and so on.
We still can't get people to stop taking supplements. Right? Supplements? People continue to take multivitamins and all these supplements. And I'm not talking about people who've had bariatric surgery who may need supplements. I'm not talking about women trying to get pregnant who need folic acid. But, you know, people just keep taking their supplements. And it's so funny to me that is sort of promoted as natural when the most natural thing is to get your vitamins from your food.
Fair enough.
You know?
Fair enough. I want to go back to the book. You wrote this book. It is the Vagina Bible. You clearly know a lot about the medical side, but you also talk a lot about sort of the physical and relationship side of sex. How does that translate into your own relationships? Before we started the podcast, you mentioned that you're in a new relationship. We won't get into any of the details, but have you ever found it's intimidating for a new partner because you have all this knowledge?
Well, you know, it's funny. So, you know, I was dating for quite some time, and many men assumed that me writing about sex meant that, of course, I wanted to sext with them. I was like, no.
Oh, wow. That's not what that means. That's not what the book is about, honey.
And that because I write about sex, clearly, you know, I just love to get, a text about how some dude is so hard for me. And I'm just like, oh. Really?
I think we've all had that thought, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So and then you meet someone who's different and is not like that, and is respectful, and so it's, I mean, I imagine, you know, perhaps, it might be a little bit intimidating at first because, you know, if I was going running with someone who was, you know, a sports medicine doctor who, you know, was also a marathon runner and knew everything about like running pace and gait and everything.
Your form is a little,
right. I would be a little intimidated, except if that person made me feel at ease and it wasn't a big deal. And then after 2 or 3 seconds, I would be totally fine. So I think that's what happened.
Right. If you find the right person, it's
right.
A non-issue,
yeah.
or it should be.
I
anyway.
Would just
it's
because...
a non-issue, although it was a non-issue, although you know, yeah. I would just say that.
I would be concerned that I would constantly be critiquing the other person because I know better. Right? Like, how do I say this in a nice way?
So this is what I tell everybody. Good sex. So sex is communication. It's just communication with your body physically. And if you can, people have a harder time talking about sex than they do having sex, which is what leads to a lot of sexual problems. If you can't tell, imagine if you never told anyone what you wanted for dinner. And the only way you communicated with them was how you were eating the meal. Like, that would suck, right? Because you might just want to know, like, if you love to make vegetarian food and your partner hates vegetarian food and all you do is serve them vegetarian food and you never talk about what you're going to have for dinner and how you're going to make it, then your partner might get resentful or they might not enjoy their meals and then you would have dinner time problem, right? So think about that with sex. So I think that because I'm open and I'm able to talk about it, then it makes the other person feel that they can too. And I would never want to judge somebody that I'm sexually active with because that's cruel and I don't want to be like that because I wouldn't want them to treat me that way. So I use that dinner analogy all the time and I just, you know, kind of take that lead. And, you know, I think that you want to show your partner that you want to communicate. You want to communicate with your body. And if you're being touched in a certain way, that's nice. You want to let them know. But it's also nice to kind of let them know in advance things that you like or don't like and go from there.
So what's next for you? Is there going to be a sequel to the Vagina Bible? Because I want more of this.
Well, yes.
I love this conversation, and I want it to keep going for generations to come. But like the only way we can do it, obviously, is for you to keep writing more books.
Well, so I do.
Do you mind?
I have another book coming out in, I guess, about 18 months called Menopause Manifesto.
Oh,
that one sounds perfect for me, actually. That sounds perfect for me because I'm in perimenopause right now, and it might be the most confusing time of my life because I wish there was sort of like a one-stop shop to understand what the hell is going on with me.
Well, I think so. The biggest piece of advice that I would give people is menopause is puberty in reverse.
Oh, God, that sounds awful.
Do you get the acne, too?
Right, like, you do.
God, that's awful.
That's why you get on Retin-A, if you can tolerate it, because Retin-A not only is the most evidence-based way to prevent wrinkles, but it treats acne.
Okay, that's excellent advice. I like both of those things you just said.
Estrogen and Retin-A on your list.
Yeah, I mean, those are the only, you know, that's what I use. So, but I think, you know, the other important thing about, so just like when you go through puberty, right? Like there's mood swings, there's your body is changing in a way and it's like, woo, what's going on? That's kind of the same thing. But we don't medicalize puberty. Right? We say, okay, well, if you have acne, let's treat it. If you have this, let's treat it. But ooh, we also accept that you have growing pains. We accept that you have these things. And so I think that it's super important to remember for perimenopause that things that are problematic, so for example, if you're having super heavy periods and soaking your clothes, that needs to be treated. But, you know, some things are also the equivalent of growing pains, and there aren't treatments for those. You just have to accept that that's a change in life, just like puberty was a change. And so I'm hoping that my book will also help people sort those things out so they can figure out, you know, what's something that can be treated, what's something that needs to be treated, and what's something that kind of has to be tolerated until it goes away because, you know, that's unfortunate. It's a phase of life and that's what happens.
Yeah, we call that the 5 years my mother went crazy. She was like, but nobody talked about it. So I think it's important that we're talking about it because, like, literally, we just wrote it off. And that's not fair.
It's such a, yeah. That, well, like you say, that's, we all do that. When you say the word menopause, people go, oh, they can make a face like, oh, you're going to go crazy now. What's happening to you? I don't know what's happening to me right now. I don't feel like I'm going crazy. I just feel like I don't know what's going on.
Well, I think that, so, society is invested in women having this crazy archetype, right? Like that's the tradition. That's what people want you to think about menopause. I didn't have one crazy thought going through menopause, nothing, right? Because I knew all the changes that were happening to my body. And I was like, okay, this is this. So I think that you just have to sort of, you know, it is true that changes in hormone levels for some women can trigger depression, can trigger anxiety. That doesn't mean that menopause is making their you know, making them quote crazy. That means that maybe it's triggering another underlying condition and that should be looked at. But I think that, you know, this idea that women are going to become, you know, these enraged beasts going through menopause is who does that serve? So I always think whenever I hear something that sounds like dogma, who does that serve? Does that myth serve women or does that myth serve men? Because it doesn't serve women.
It serves neither, actually.
No, it serves men to dismiss. It serves the patriarchy to dismiss women.
Right. It's funny because it's almost like a joke in my place of work, or it used to be a joke. I used to work with a gentleman who would always like to shame me because I had told him that I'm like, you know, getting like hot and whatever. But that was his like, and it was just like a running joke. Sandra's hot today. Sandra's in a mood today. And it was like, that's what he loved to do. He loved to shame me because I was going through perimenopause. What an asshole.
Maybe you're in a mood because he's a fucking asshole, not because of anything
Well,
else.
Definitely now that I hear that and I remember feeling bad about it and thinking, and there's also the ageist part of
Absolutely.
It too. That's another thing entirely that it's never easy for anybody, man or woman, getting old, but menopause is associated with being a woman of a certain age and being mature.
Which
you know what I mean?
Like you're really not. You're halfway through your life. That's not old.
You know, there's many studies that tell us that societies that have grandmothers, so women, you know, women who have, you know, we keep, women live for a very long time after they finish reproducing, which is unique among mammals. Most mammals reproduce and then they're done. And so the fact that we live for long times in after we've finished reproducing is a sign that that benefits society. And if you think about it, now I'm going to really talk about this in the book. If you think about it, myth, famine, and all these things that happen to different cultures around the world, different groups of people, these things happen not like every 5 or 6 years. Often these sort of environmental catastrophes happen every 20, every 30 years. So think about it. A culture is more likely to survive if they have people that have that historical memory. So if you have the 60-year-old who says, I remember when I was 20 and we had this happen and my mom went and we found out that we could actually eat those plants. Or, so if you think about having people who live a long time not only helps with child rearing, helps with, they can look after the children while the stronger people are out foraging or hunting or, getting food, but also they have this historical memory of what people have done in times of, famine or times of flood or times of, when they were invaded by, whoever. So I think that this idea that this collective cultural memory that what I would call grandmothers, but there are also many women who never got pregnant and never reproduced who also lived long lives, that these collective older women contributed to society in a lot of ways because those societies are more successful than societies that didn't have them.
I can already tell you that I can't wait for that next book to come out. I can't wait to read it and move forward with the conversation. I know that we only had you for a certain amount of time, Jen, so I want to thank you for coming on our podcast today. I loved talking to you.
So fun, Jen. Thank you so much. The author of The Vagina Bible. Jen, where can people get it?
People can get The Vagina Bible at every bookstore. They can buy it at Indigo Chapters. They can get it at independent bookstores. They can buy it from Amazon. They can get it at Shoppers Drug Mart. They can get it at Costco. And they can find links through drjengunter.com. And they can also find me on Twitter at Dr. Jen Gunter, on Instagram at Dr. Jen Gunter, and on Facebook at Dr. Jen Gunter.
We get it. You're Jen Gunter.
Exactly.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
This episode is over, but the conversation doesn't have to be. Follow Hillary and Sandra on social. Instagram at Hillary on Air, at SandraKiss1053. Twitter at Hillary Welch, at SandraKiss1053. And on Facebook at Quick and Dirty Podcast. Got a question? Email Hillary and Sandra, thequickandthedirty@gmail.com. Don't forget, you can download the podcast each week to your mobile device to listen offline. Find The Quick and the Dirty on frequencypodcastnetwork.com, iTunes, or wherever you download your podcasts.